From the West Australian, I'm Ben O'Shea, and this is The West Live.
The West Live.
The West Live
with Ben O'Shea.
When you listen to Treasurer Josh Frydenberg deliver his budget speech tonight, you might have to remind yourself he represents the Liberal Party. That's because the words that'll come out of his mouth will be so unlike those uttered by any Liberal Treasurer that has come before him. Normally, you'd expect a budget from a Conservative government to preach the virtues of sound economic management, cutting debt and striving for a surplus. But a pandemic has a funny way of turning politics on its head. Instead of spruiking a plan for a surplus, Frydo is sending the country headfirst into a deficit it'll take years to climb out of. And this most unliberal budget doesn't end there. How the government is spending its money is just as unusual. Billions going to childcare, women's health, the elderly, and suicide prevention. Money to help single parents buy homes. And it comes after the Morrison government has thrown billions at stimulating the economy, propping up jobs and boosting the welfare safety net as Australia's health response to the virus wrecked economic havoc. Billions on welfare. Such spending is going to create a few headaches for governments of the future, but Frydenberg says budget repair cannot begin until national unemployment has been driven down from its current rate of 5.6%. We all know these are unprecedented times, and today it looks like we're going to get a budget that is unprecedented too. Coming up on the show, The West's federal political editor Lani Scar predicts some budget winners and losers. We remember Russell Goodrick and what a $1 billion telescope in the WA outback will mean for the state. But before all that, let's see what's making news.
The West Live. Making news.
Joining me now is Sunrise correspondent Matt Tinney. G'day, Matt.
Ben, happy Tuesday. How good is the weather in Perth at the moment?
Oh, it's beautiful. This is the best time of year, I reckon, when you get these beautiful autumn days that are a little bit fresh, but the sun is shining, just so beautiful to be outside. And of course,
and you can still swim. I went for a swim yesterday in the ocean and it wasn't even that cold.
Do you know, I went for a walk down by the ocean last night and it looked absolutely beautiful. I didn't hop in though.
You didn't hop in? Well, there's a challenge for you by tomorrow. I want to hear like how cold it feels.
Now, I might catch a cold, which is better than COVID. So let's get the COVID wrap today. Some news?
Well, we've got some news. So in terms of travel restrictions, I'd been banging on about earlier, Victoria classing us as an orange zone here in Perth. And that meant if you wanted to fly to Melbourne, you'd have to fly over there, isolate, get a test within 3 days, and then stay isolated till you got a negative result. Well, they have changed that. So we're now a green zone in line, interestingly, with New South Wales, which has been chasing a missing link to their outbreak. But it means you can fly to Melbourne now. You just need a permit, which is very easy to get online, and you don't have to get tested or isolate there unless you have symptoms or unless you're asked to. So much easier for people to fly over there. A lot of footy fans very happy about this this morning.
Yeah, that's fantastic news. And now, not so fantastic, talking about footy, some news involving Willy Rioli.
Yeah, this is just breaking. So he's been accused of being in possession of cannabis at Darwin Airport. Northern Territory police say that drug detection dogs stopped him and he was found with 25 grams of cannabis down his pants. He's due to face court tomorrow. We're hearing the Eagles are going to be holding a media conference at 10 o'clock this morning. So we'll hear more about that situation. Of course, he's been serving that backdated 2-year ban. That was due to expire in August 20, I think it is. So the plan was for him to commence training ahead of that with the Eagles. So this is a real spanner in the works.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look forward to hearing more about that. And we're going to talk about it a bit later on in the show today. And Maddie, always great to talk to you. We'll see you tomorrow on The West Live.
Will do. Cheers, mate.
You're listening to The West Live.
Treasurer Josh Frydenberg will hand down his third budget later today. And joining me now to give us a sneak preview is the West Australian's federal political editor, Lani Scar. Good morning, Lani.
Good morning.
Now, you've covered your fair share of federal budgets. What's the mood around this one?
Look, everyone is obviously excited to be back in the building, excited that it's going to be a bit more of a normal budget feel compared to how things were last year in October. I think, though, people do feel that, certainly from the stuff we've seen so far in the lead up to budget, that it's kind of a sprinkle budget. So everything gets a little bit of a sprinkle of a top up of extra money, but there's nothing sort of groundbreaking that changes the dial. Aged care is obviously going to get a huge investment following the Royal Commission. What we've seen so far in the reporting is that aged care will get $18 billion of new funding. But everything else is a bit of a sprinkle. It's neutralising the argument on childcare. It's putting some money into mental health. All of these things are good things, but it's not a revolutionary budget. But things could change tonight at 7:30 when we all know exactly what's in the budget papers. But so far, that's kind of the mood from people I've been speaking to.
And is it too early to say whether there are any obvious winners and losers out of this budget that's coming tonight?
I think what most sectors will feel is that they've won a little bit. Right. So going back to what I said in regards to it being a sprinkle budget, I mean, the mental health sector will feel they've won a little bit. You know, $2 billion is a big investment, but it doesn't fix the structural problems that we see in the mental health sector. Aged care will obviously be happy because it's a massive $18 billion investment. But again, I think that they could feel that there's more work to be done. Childcare as well, it's a significant investment, but again, they'll feel there's more to be done. So, look, I think it's a very good question about whether there'll be clear winners and losers out of this budget, but I think what the government is trying to do, certainly, is make everyone feel a little bit happy. So going into a federal election next year, everyone will feel like they got a bit of something, but it won't be as though one sector in particular thinks that this is an amazing budget for them.
Mm. And if you had to put your finger on where some surprises might come from tonight, where do you think we could see some shocks?
Well, I mean, it's been discussed in the media in the lead up, but certainly we will see, we've got a story in the paper today, but certainly we will see a move from the assumptions on iron ore. And I think West Australians have to be really proud of that, that really a lot of the budget is going to be propped up by the record iron ore prices that we're seeing. Yesterday it soared to $226 a tonne. So we are going to see a move away from the really conservative iron ore assumption price that we saw in last year's budget and also the mid-year economic update. So I think I am very interested to see whether they're going to still be quite conservative and have that still on the lower side but increased, or whether they will accept that actually iron ore prices are not going down, and no one expects them to go down significantly anytime soon, and whether it'll be more around the $130 to $150 assumption price.
Mm. And with a federal election on the horizon, just how significant is this budget, do you think, for Prime Minister Scott Morrison's re-election chances?
It is significant because it's laying down the frameworks for an election budget. When I spoke to Josh Frydenberg, we had a one-on-one interview on Friday. He still is describing this as a pandemic budget. So I think that anything can happen in politics, as we've seen many times over the years. But I would be expecting that Josh Frydenberg and Scott Morrison would be hoping that there will be another budget before the next federal election so that they can do all of the big promises and spending that we generally see in an election budget. The political mood may change, that an election may be brought forward to potentially at the end of this year or early next year before the budget, but I think either way, even if it is a pandemic budget as the Treasurer describes it, it still is laying down the framework for an election next year.
Mm. And what about the opposition? How do you anticipate Anthony Albanese will try and attack a budget that, as you say, gives a little bit of a sprinkle to so many sectors?
It's really hard. I had a meeting this morning with an assistant minister in the Labor Party, and it's really, really hard because this is the strategy that the Morrison government is employing to give sprinkles to everything. So it's harder to have the opposition attack it because, you know, last year we saw the Labor Party come out and take a stand on childcare and really have something in their budget that was, or their budget reply, that was really different to what the government was doing. But, you know, it makes it much harder for Labor to attack. So I think that they need something that makes people stand up and listen and is different to all the little sprinkles that we see across the Morrison government's budget. So it kind of has to be something different to aged care. It kind of has to be a lot more than what the government is doing on mental health. It has to be more than what the government is doing in childcare, because otherwise the argument's lost.
Mm. Well, you're about to go into budget lockup today. We look forward to reading your reporting on everything that Josh Frydenberg says tonight. The West Australian's federal political editor, Lani Scar, thanks for being on The West Live.
Thanks for having me.
Some very sad news this morning with the death of legendary Perth broadcaster Russell Goodrick. He anchored Nine News for many years, where he earned a Logie, and he'll be sorely missed by many friends and colleagues, including Jenny Seaton. Good morning, Jenny.
Good morning to you, Ben. Yeah, it's pretty hard to process, really. I mean, I know we're all getting to that age and stage in life, but it's still not real, I suppose, when you hear of your mates going. It's a very sad situation, and it wasn't something we knew about. This is the other part of it that we're trying to sort of understand, I suppose. He was private. He wanted it to be this way, but to find out that he was in a coma for so long and this was the result, it's just awful.
Well, his death has come as a shock to many in the industry and, of course, the people who loved watching him on TV. When did you find out that he was unwell, and do you know much about the circumstances?
Yeah. Look, this is the thing. No, we didn't, because I think he requested that if he was in a state that he could have requested, or his family requested for him. But I've only found out today that he had a problem with his pancreas and he was on going down south. He was working on a film, a local movie, a war film, and he was on his way down. He had an attack of some description and he had to be flown back, RFDS. We were told last week he was in a coma, but we weren't told why and how bad it was. And it was only really this morning, or last night, I got a text from a friend to say that they decided to let the machine go off him to keep him alive. And I don't know, it's just, it shouldn't be a shock when all of us at our age are going, but it's just so sad when he gave so much. Along with a lot of other people, but Russell was unique in his way. He was gentle. He was always happy and smiling. He was a little bit childlike in ways, not in a bad way, but sweet, a bit vulnerable, but very professional in everything that he did. And his friends really appreciated what he did.
Mm. And you worked with Russell in the Channel 9 days. What do you think made him so beloved with the audience?
I think he connected with people. This is the whole thing, I think, with success with presenters. If you are pretty much down to earth, if you're not, people see through you. If you can connect verbally and visually and everything, that's what I think the public feel comfortable with. If, you know, if you're sitting at home watching someone trying to be something they're not, you're not comfortable watching them. So I think that's what he did, and I think everyone did in those days. We were all at that stage, we were still learning as we went. Television, you know, I was 68 at Channel 9 in black and white. God for heaven, you wouldn't have even been born. And so we were all learning on the job, all of us. And, you know, Russell came in and he had so much enthusiasm to do what he did, to go on and do the real estate program and be around the corridors of Channel 9. He loved reading the news. He just loved it. And when they came out with this campaign, Russell told me so, he reveled in that. He used to throw his suit jacket over his shoulder and sort of swagger up the corridor.
Well, he was a lively and pretty adventurous bloke. It must have been fun times.
Oh, look, every day was a challenge for everybody. And the news at that stage back then probably wasn't considered as important as it is today. There was more live television studio out of the studios, right, with entertainment and, you know, shows and that sort of thing and daytime programs. But news became huge. I remember David Asmore came back from America, and over there they were doing 24-hour news programs. And he said, I'm telling you, this is the future. It took a bit of a time for it to happen, but it definitely did. So Russell was very happy to be part of all those changes, I think.
It really was a golden era for TV in Western Australia. And now it is sad, as you say, when we start to lose these local legends.
Yeah. Well, look, we can all be accused of saying, oh, gee, in the good old days, you know, but to be honest with you, it was like a form of local Hollywood, the television stations, you know, 7 and 9, and then 10 started up a little bit later. And the studios were full of set designers, programs churning out every single day, and things always change. They have to change. It's, you know, it's a business. And we're seeing that change very strongly now. And Russell hung on to what he was involved in for many, many years, and people appreciated what he did and all the others did at that time too.
And then he wasn't immune to change as well. He was versatile and tried his hand at many things post TV, from politics and movie production.
Yeah.
Did you stay in touch with him?
Oh, absolutely. We used to go to the same supermarket. I was in Maylands at the time and he was in Bayswater. I think on my Facebook page I got photos of Russell and I together buying our tomatoes and everything. So, we kept in touch. We didn't see each other all the time, but we were definitely in touch. And at all the reunions, Russell would always be there. So it was, he just loved catching up with everybody and remembering the days we all used to work together at the Channel 9 studios. It was so much fun.
And there sure is an outpouring on Facebook today. It shows just how many people he touched during his life.
Look, yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of other people that were around that time on telly, people found television very comforting and very personal back then. There weren't the choices that we've got today, where you've got pay TV and all those other things and, you know, iPads and everything. So television at night was it. That was your entertainment for your news service. Yeah, everyone sat down and watched the news at 6 o'clock at night. You know, it was really a huge part of people's lives.
And his family must be devastated. His children grew up with him being on television like many of us did.
Yeah. Oh, of course. Every family would be obviously devastated to lose their partners or father or mother or whatever. But he, of course, was on a mission about the family court as well, as you might have also read. He was very concerned that it wasn't fair for one parent only to have full custody of a child and the other children not being able to see the other parent. And I think a lot of people would agree with him there. He had a lot of plans for the future, Russell. He wasn't giving up. He was going to be involved in politics and the tourism industry and family court changes. He was a worker, that's for sure.
And we pass our condolences on to his family. Jenny Seaton, yeah. Thanks for remembering your mate with us today on The West Live.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you very much, Ben.
Breaking news in the Eagles camp this morning with Revelations star player Willie Rioli is set to appear in court on drug charges. Joining me now is sports editor for the Sunday Times, Glenn Quartermain. G'day, Quarters.
Hey, Ben, how are you, mate? Good morning.
Good. Now, what can you tell us about these charges?
Well, what we know is that he was found by a sniffer dog at Darwin Airport on April 23 of this year, heading to the Tiwi Islands. He had 25 grams, allegedly, of cannabis in his pocket. The charge is possessing a Schedule II dangerous drug in a quantity less than trafficable in a public place. So, allegedly found with 25 grams. So, under normal circumstances, that's a fine. But, of course, these are exceptional circumstances. Willie Rioli is coming off a 2-year ban for urine substitution. There was a lesser ban of positive to cannabis as well. So he's coming off that 2 years, due back to train with the Eagles on June 20, and will be available to play on August 20. Now, I guess we've got to assume innocence till he faces his day in court tomorrow. But if he is found guilty of that, I think we need to ask three questions. And given the Eagles are scrambling this morning, there's a 10 a.m. press conference. They've been having an emergency meeting this morning. The first question I would ask is, did the Eagles know? Now, if they didn't know, if they weren't informed of this charge, then he has got some answering to do. The second question I would ask is, does he really want to play footy? Now, I think most people were frustrated by the process of Sports Integrity Australia and WADA. It took a long time for Willie to find out his fate. But ultimately, I think given the what he actually did was urine substitution, I think he was a very lucky boy to be given a two-year penalty. And now, if he's found guilty of this, I think it's sort of snubbing your nose at the whole situation, really. So you've got to ask the question, how much does he really want to play footy if he's found guilty? And the third thing I'd ask is, if he is found guilty again, should he play this year? The Eagles will be under a bit of pressure to answer that question. I guess there should be some punishment meted out to him. He, as I said, he is due to resume playing on August 20, training on June 20. All these questions, I guess, will be answered after his day in court tomorrow in Darwin Court.
And supposing that he is found guilty, what sort of a view on this would the club and the AFL take, given the fact that he's just come off this two-year ban?
They'd be very angry. I'd say they'd be very angry right now. And I think there would have to be a further punishment, given what he's just... And also given the efforts of people to get him... get that penalty down to 2 years. I mean, there's been a lot of work. We all know how gifted Willie is. We all want to see him out on that footy oval because he is brilliant to watch. But, you know, all the efforts put in by these people, and he's basically, if he's found guilty of this charge, it's really unprofessional. And I would be stunned if there wasn't a further punishment handed to him if he's found guilty.
Do you know what, can you give us a rough idea of what the precedent might be when it comes to this type of infringement?
Oh, look, it's only a week or two given, and often it's just a fine. And look, with players in the limelight, the punishment is often more the spotlight itself than the actual punishment. So it's not something that you would miss any length of time for doing. But this is a extenuating circumstances, so it's really difficult to sort of get a handle on what the AFL or what the Eagles might do. I think it'll definitely be left in the hands of the Eagles, and I guess that's what they'll be meeting this morning to decide. I would expect them to come out and say, look, he's got to face his day in court tomorrow. But as again, I'll repeat, I would just be stunned if there was no further punishment if he's found guilty.
We'll have to wait and see what the Eagles say today and then what happens tomorrow when he faces his day in court. Sports editor for the Sunday Times, Glenn Quatermain, thanks for your time this morning.
Pleasure, Ben.
Oh, Mick, you frighten shit out of me.
So I ought to, mate. Sneaking up on a man when he's rendering first aid to a lady.
Is that what you were doing?
That was an iconic scene from Crocodile Dundee featuring Paul Hogan and Australia's greatest Aboriginal actor, David Gulpilil. After 5 decades in the entertainment industry, Gulpilil's legacy is assured. But with the actor battling terminal lung cancer, director Molly Reynolds took a camera crew to film what she thought would be the final moments of an incredible life. She joins me now to discuss it. Molly, welcome to Perth and welcome to The West Live.
Thank you, Ben.
And now, firstly, congratulations on My Name is Gulpilil. It really is a wonderful film. I watched it last night. Why was it important to make it?
I think you opened beautifully. You know, yes, he has a legacy that we really should, you know, we should sure that it doesn't disappear, because he was the first. He was one of the first black fellas on screen. Not only that, he was an actor. He was a thespian. He could hold his own. And in many ways, he's going to be the last, because he was born in the bush under a tree. He was cast in films because he was a great dancer and a great hunter. And those traditions, you know, they're gone. And when David dies, you know, there's another old fella who could who could, you know, do all those things and won't be able to do them. You know, the younger ones can't do that anymore.
Well, the irony of that scene from Crocodile Dundee that I played was that that Mick Dundee introduces David's character Neville as, oh, he's a city slicker, which is exactly the opposite to what David Gulpilil was in real life. Can you tell us a little bit about where he was from in the Northern Territory?
A place in northeast Arnhem Land. He's actually, his country is Gulpilil, and I don't even know if I can quite pronounce that rightly. And he lived in Maningrida. He has lived in Ramanginning, the townships that were developed at the time to bring all the mobs together and kind of, you know, I suppose stop them going walkabout across the lands. And he didn't much care for the city, but now he lives in Murray Bridge in South Australia, which is just outside Adelaide. And I think he's needed to reconcile himself to what is urban and what is city, because the nature of his treatment is that, well, the nature of his illness means that he needs the best of care treatment.
It's fascinating to watch him in that sort of built-up urban environment. I grew up in Arnhem Land myself, and so I'm much more familiar with seeing him in that sort of very natural environment in his country. Seeing him in South Australia talking about, you know, white fella medicine and getting treatment for his lung cancer, it's quite difficult to watch. How, I guess, emotionally challenging was it to film such intimate moments?
Look, you know, being in the very, very company of David is that he has a charisma, he has a, you know, a magnetism, and so he always brings you into his mood, into his, you know, into his storytelling at the time. So, you know, spending time with David is always a memorable experience. I think when one is close to illness, it is it's sort of not as confronting. And I mean, you know, in sort of kind of, I didn't notice David's deterioration as someone might if they haven't seen somebody for, you know, 3 months or half a year and whatever else. But often when I look back at the documentary and I see the footage play, I feel the weight of it. I feel the weight of someone who's sort of facing their mortality.
And I'm going to ask you a tough question here about your favourite performance of David's. Mine is in your partner and fellow filmmaker, Rolf De Heer's The Tracker, one of my absolute favourite Aussie films. Do you have a favourite?
I'd agree with you, Ben. I reckon it is.
You'd be in trouble if you didn't say that.
Yes, I reckon it would be the Tracker. The Tracker is a remarkable, you know, really a remarkable, remarkable film. And what is all the more amazing is that was David's first lead role. You know, there he is, sort of in his mid 40s. Well, yeah, crossover between 40s and 50s, and he had not yet been cast in a lead role. And that was for a few reasons. You know, one was he was a man of many addictions, and so he would kind of indulge those perhaps a little bit more than his work. But there weren't those sort of roles for a black fella until then is now somewhat remarkable.
Well, you talk about indulging some of those addictions. He addresses that in your film. It talks about making a movie with Dennis Hopper where they were pretty much stoned for 2 weeks of making the film, ended up in New South Wales lockup 10 times in 24 days or something like that. Can you give us some idea of some of the other amazing things that David has done, the experiences that he's had that he shares in the film?
Oh, you mean getting stoned with Bob Marley?
Yeah, or you're getting stoned with Bob Marley's, dinner with the Queen.
Oh, yes. A deer steak. He met Clint Eastwood, and Clint Eastwood had a barbecue and cooked him deer steak. That didn't quite make the cut, but he certainly has met all the legends over the time, you know, and in part because he's a legend himself, really. And his experiences with Dennis Hopper. I dare say you've seen Heart of Darkness, which is a film about the making of Apocalypse Now. And Dennis Hopper was quite wasted. Well, in fact, most of the actors, I mean, Martin Sheen was an alcoholic, were quite, you know, sort of quite off their face through much of the shoot. And I kind of, Dennis Hopper, I go, whoa, you're hardcore. And he admits to that. And then I think there he is parting with David, which just sort of goes to, you just can just imagine the extent of it, you know, how hard they would have partied.
Yeah, and as David admits in the film, you know, like his sort of lifelong addiction to ganja, as he says, has led to this terminal lung cancer. When you started making this film, I imagine you thought you'd be chronicling the end of this great life. It didn't really turn out that way. He's still with us. How did that change the movie?
Oh, look, it in unexpected ways. Basically, it was David. We started making this film with a sense of urgency in, you know, sort of March, April of 2017, because David was meant to be dead by the end, you know, by 2018. He wasn't going to see in the new year. And David being David defied the odds, and 2018 rolled into 2019. And then at the beginning of 2020, Rolf said, "Molly, David is, you know, he's doing well. He may live for another decade yet. I think we have to look to finishing the film differently." And I said, "No," because Rolf's the producer and I'm the director. And so I said, no, you know, this is going to finish with him in his grave. And Rolf said, no, we'll go bankrupt. And I thought, he's right. So we spoke with David, and David said, you know, and pitched it well to David. It's like, "David, I know that this was going to be with you in your grave, but what happens if we finish it with you on stage?" And David loves celebrity. Like, I think if he was about to die and and there were people in the room and they started applauding, he'd come to and say, "Here I am." And so he said, "Yeah, I'll take the stage." And I, as a filmmaker, you know, I was really concerned because I had a cut. It was geared towards David's death. But for those of your audience who do see the film, it found its natural ending. And I was really relieved and surprised by that. And I think the ending holds no matter what happens next.
Yeah, I think it's a celebration of his life, which it would have been if he wasn't with us anymore. But the fact that he is, I think, just does give it a very positive tone that I know that everybody's been loving. It's screened at a couple of film festivals already, and the response has been pretty incredible.
Yes, but then that's David, you know. David just needs to walk down the street and people turn their heads because, you know, he has such an incredible physicality. Most of us walk to, you know, get from A to B. He glides, and you having seen the film, Ben, you know, even if he sort of, as he shuffles to and from the mailbox, he's still got a
in his UGG boots. So cool. He is just the coolest cat. And the opening of the film where he's standing on that sort of dirt road with the emu, first off, it took me a while to get over how incredible his outfit was. He's just a stylish dude.
Oh,
he really is.
Oh, yeah, and it's important to him. And I've seen, you know, I've kind of travelled with David, and I've seen his bag when he packs it. It's like a television commercial. It is impeccable. All his shirts beautifully folded, you know. I dare say he's got them in an order because he knows what he would like to wear what day. He loves looking good and any excuse for a suit. And he, you know, puts on his suit with his polished shoes. Yeah.
Yeah, the word icon is thrown around a lot these days. I think it's almost, you know, it is overused to the point it almost has lost its meaning, but he definitely is someone who it applies to perfectly. He's an icon. And now you've got the premiere in Perth tonight. I hear
yes.
Ernie Dingo is going to be there. Ben White, the former treasurer, first Indigenous treasurer of Australia, is going to be there. What do you hope white people take away from this film?
That's a big question. I Okay, I'm just going to throw back to another film that David and I made together called Another Country. And that one spoke about clash between cultures, and that was time, rubbish and money. And I think it's about two-way learning. And interestingly enough, David has a fantastic doctor at the Royal Adelaide Hospital, and I've come to know him over the years, and he's an oncologist. And at the end of the film, he sought me out and he said, "Thank you, Molly. Thank you. I understand so much more." And I think that insight to David straddling two cultures, I think helps us understand difference and others, and brings a sort of greater sense of compassion.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think it's for a lot of people who don't have a lot of, I think, experience or background interacting with Aboriginal people, I think this is it will be a real eye-opening movie, and I guess just reinforces this rich culture that we have in this country that I think we've taken for granted for far too long. And David Gulpilil has been such a wonderful, wonderful ambassador for it. And my name is Gulpilil. We'll hit theatres on May 27. Director Molly Reynolds, thanks for being on The West Live.
Thank you.
You're listening to The West Live.
700 kilometres north of Perth, deep in WA's Murchison region, a billion-dollar radio telescope is being built. The Square Kilometre Array will be the biggest scientific instrument ever built in Australia when it's finished, and it'll give us an unprecedented view of the universe. The project reached another milestone last night with the appointment of Dr. Sarah Pierce. She was the acting chief scientist of the CSIRO, but will now be the director of the SKA project in Australia, and she joins me now. Good morning, Sarah, and congratulations on the new job.
Thank you very much. It's very exciting.
And now, so for those who came in late, can you give us a quick rundown on what the SKA is and why it has astronomers so excited?
Yeah, look, the SKA is a large international project. It's got 16 countries that are part of it, and it's going to build two next generation radio telescopes, one in South Africa and one in Australia. So this is a great opportunity for Australia. It's our first time to host one of these enormous mega science international projects. And in Australia, we'll be building a telescope called SKA Low. So it'll spread across the Murchison region of Western Australia and help us look back to the dawn of time, not long after the Big Bang.
You had me at mega science. And so can you tell me, why is it being built in Western Australia?
And Australia is a great place to do radio astronomy. First of all, we've got a really long history of it. So you probably know about the Parkes telescope, for example.
Yes.
It's more than 50 years old. But we've got two other great advantages. Firstly, we're in the Southern Hemisphere, and you want to be in the Southern Hemisphere because you get a better view of the galactic center. So both of SKA telescopes will be built in the Southern Hemisphere. But we've also got a lot of land, and radio telescopes need to be in areas that are very quiet. Because all our day-to-day activities using our computers and our phones and our cars and our fridges interfere with what we're trying to look for with the radio telescopes. And so we want to go to an area where there are very few people. And so this is why the telescope is being built in a remote area of Western Australia.
And I've been lucky enough to visit the site, and there wasn't much there at the time. What will it eventually look like, and what is the timeline of getting this telescope finished?
So we actually have a couple of radio telescopes on the site already, which are precursors for the SKA. So there's one, which is a CSIRO telescope called ASCAP, which is starting to do great science. And another telescope managed by Curtin University called the Murchison Wide Field Array, which is a low-frequency telescope, a bit like SKA, but smaller. And so in the end, though, we will build 130,000 antennas across 60 kilometres of desert in Western Australia. And each of the antennas they're about 2 metres tall, and they look a bit like a Christmas tree made of aluminium. And so you'll be able to stand there, surrounded by tens of thousands of antennas, which are all working together to get us really unique views of the sky.
And people can actually go into the new WA Museum, and there's a display devoted to the Murchison Radio Astronomy Observatory, and you can see one of these antennas for yourself, or a prototype of one. And now, when the observations come through, when do you think that will happen, and what do you think we'll be learning?
Yeah, so we're going to start building the telescope towards the end of this year, maybe the beginning of next year. And it'll take probably 7 or 8 years to build the full telescope. But data will start to come through well before that. And in fact, you know, it will only be a few years into construction of the telescope that it will be the biggest low-frequency radio telescope in the world already. So the real core science case for the telescope in Australia is what we call the cosmic dawn. So it's looking back to a few hundred million years after the Big Bang, to when the very first stars and galaxies started to shine. And no telescope has ever been able to see this yet. And so we hope that SKA Low will help us for the first time to understand the processes that led to those stars and galaxies forming.
Mm. And looking a little bit closer to home, are there economic and scientific benefits to WA of having the SKA here in our state?
Absolutely. And so, firstly, I think there are direct economic benefits, right? So there'll be roles for Australian industry. For example, we'll be leading building the infrastructure on the site and the roads and the buildings, and in building some of the more high-tech parts of the telescope too. But then there's also sort of longer-term benefits, because the SKA is an enormous big data telescope. It has to deal with 7 terabits of data a second. That's about 100,000 home broadband networks. So if you can imagine 100,000 kind of Netflix streaming going all at the same time, that's the kind of volume of data we need to deal with for SKA. And of course, in order to do that, we and the companies who are helping us develop SKA will learn an enormous amount about dealing with big data, and will also build great capability for Australia, lots of expertise, and attract experts here to work on this, who then can go out and work in industry in other areas apart from astronomy.
Mm. Exciting times ahead. SKA Director Dr. Sarah Pearce, thanks for being on the West Live this morning.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
The Wild West.
Well, she's back from her long weekend away. Perth Now editor Nat Richards, welcome back to the show.
Good morning, thank you.
How was your long weekend?
It was smashing. Just relaxing, lovely. I managed to get away this time. There's no lockdown to stop me, so
well, fantastic. Well, you know what? It's almost too easy to segue from your escape into this next story.
Yes. So I knew where you were going with that one. Well done.
this story just really blows my mind. It's the sort of thing that, you know, you'd expect to see, you know, sort of Steve McQueen in The Great Escape or something like that.
Something off a movie, this, all over. So over at Yonga Hill Detention Centre, which is up at Northam, they've managed to find an escape tunnel. And it's honestly got to be seen to be believed, I reckon. It's managed to make it within 5 metres of the boundary. So they're about 20.
So they got close?
Yeah, massive. Absolutely massive. 20 metres long. It's taken them 3 months, they reckon. And it's only just been discovered, which is kind of heartbreaking for them that they got so close, isn't it?
So they've drilled. They've taken 3 months to dig this tunnel.
Yeah.
And they've nearly made it to freedom, and then they've been busted.
Yeah. And it's, they're people in immigration detention, so they don't tend to be, you know, these guys aren't murderers, but still, I mean, it's against the law, you're not supposed to try and escape. But this has gone from the floor of a room 6F, which was apparently being used by a man who was what they call a 501, and a 501 is somebody that was going to be basically deported because they're not allowed to stay.
Criteria.
No, so I guess it was a bit of a last ditch attempt to
make her do a runner.
To stay. I wonder how they, because I'm imagining if you're tunnelling, you're going to get a big pile of dirt, right, from your excavation. And then how do you get away with it? Like, I think in the Great Escape, they like tucked it into their pants and they sort of walked around and they shook the leg of their pants and the dirt came out the bottom to sprinkle it around the quadrangle.
There's that. And there's also, they don't know how this person's managed to do it. I mean, either they've got some serious rough hands that they've managed to get through the dirt with, or I don't know, spoons.
Yeah. So much we don't know about this story.
I have no idea how they managed to do it.
They put rafters and stuff in there, like it was a mining tunnel to stop it from collapsing.
I have no idea. It can't have been very safe, can it, really?
No,
you wouldn't have much to work with when you're in immigration detention. And this person's managed to make it through two of the internal fences. So managed to bypass both of those and came heartbreakingly close to the end.
It's amazing. I think we shouldn't deport this guy because he's clearly an engineering master. You know what I mean? Like, we're trying to build the Forest Field Airport link right now. With those tunnels.
Tunnel boring machines.
Do you know how much those tunnel borers cost? Yeah. They cost billions of dollars.
Look at it. Old bloke from 6F down there.
Yeah, this bloke and his teaspoon. He'll have it done.
Well, we get done quicker.
Yeah, we'll have it done in no time.
Yeah,
well, brilliant. That's pretty amazing. And, I'm reading in the story on Perth Now that it's not the first time someone has tried to tunnel out of a detention centre.
Oh,
it happened at Villawood in Sydney back in 2001 when 23 asylum seekers actually managed to escape by tunneling out.
It's the sort of stuff that you don't think happens in real life, and yet someone's given it a crack.
Yeah.
And
good on them.
Yeah.
And now this is sad news for Adele, the sort of best selling pop star.
Yes.
She's lost a family.
I know we're supposed to be the light relief at this end of the day, but unfortunately, Adele has lost her father, and anybody who follows Adele quite closely will know that she's had a turbulent relationship with her dad over the years. He buggered off when she was three, and she was obviously not very happy about that and has had a very rocky relationship with him ever since. And she had a son, as we all know, Angelo, and the dad had come out in the press previously and said he worried he'd never meet him because he had bowel cancer. And this was way back in 2013. And now it's turned out that, you know, they have managed to reconcile over this time. So, I mean, it's taken him 8 years to pop his clogs. And in that time, she's managed to reconcile with him and they've managed to have a reasonable sort of relationship, which is nice. And he's died now and obviously she's mourning. And it just shows, doesn't it? It just shows that, you know, there's no point holding grudges forever. There's just no point.
Yep.
Because everybody, we all go in the same way, aren't we? So in that, it's quite nice that they did manage to make up. But obviously she's still going to be mourning and very sad for her because she's had a rotten stretch, hasn't she, Adele?
Yeah, yep, definitely. And I think it's more than anything, it's that reminder of, you know, like if your family's going through a bit of a rough patch, don't let petty differences come between you because something like this will happen and it'll make you realise that there are bigger things in life.
Yes.
You only get one dad, you only get one mum and one brother, and you might get more than one brother or sister, but once you lose your family, you can't get them back. So make the most of the time while you got it.
Yes, there we go. That's our final thought.
That's
very Jerry Springer, isn't it?
Final thought for the day. Yeah, exactly. Well, I can't wait to see what tomorrow's final thoughts are. Nat Richards from Perth Now, thanks for being on The West Live. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thank you, Ben.
And that's it from me today. You can catch us live tomorrow morning when we return to thewest.com.au and Perth Now at 8:45 a.m. And you can stream the full show whenever you want by searching for The West Live wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to The West Live with Ben O'Shea. If the story behind the story matters to you, then you can count on thewest.com.au to deliver.